The headlines this hour: Iran unveils a new advanced homemade drone capable of enhanced flight range and duration. New day, a new Israeli crime. The regime forces killed a Palestinian man near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. And South Africa hosts the 15th annual BRICS summit as the bloc weighs the admission of new members, including Iran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has unveiled an advanced homemade drone in an official ceremony attended by President Ebrahim Raisi. The drone, dubbed Mohajer 10, is capable of remaining airborne for 24 hours at an altitude of 7,000 meters and an operational range of 2,000 kilometers. The maximum speed of the drone is 210 kilometers per hour. The unmanned aerial vehicle is also equipped with electronic warfare and intelligence systems. Apart from President Raisi, a number of top brass military commanders were present at the unveiling ceremony. The Iranian president also ordered the delivery of strategic missiles of Haj Qasem and Khorramshahr to the armed forces. In recent years, the Islamic Republic has made major headways in manufacturing military equipment, which is aimed at boosting its self-defense. Tehran has called piracy the seizure of an Iranian oil tanker by the U.S. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the era of hit-and-run is over. That in reaction to reports that the U.S. has begun unloading the vessel. We've discussed the issue in our news review program.
Iran's foreign ministry has reacted to reports on the U.S.'s unloading an Iranian oil tanker. Spokesman Nasser Kanani stressed that the era of hit and run is over. The official said in his weekly presser that any aggression against Iranian tankers amounts to piracy and a violation of international law. Kanani did not confirm reports on the U.S.'s unloading of Iranian oil tanker. However, he stressed that Tehran will not remain idle in defending its rights and the rights of the nation. Kanani said those who plan any infringement of Iranian assets should remember the history of Iran's reactions in similar cases. Now, the comments came in response to reports that a cargo of Iranian crude carried by Suez Rajan was being unloaded off the coast of Texas. The vessel was seized by the U.S. 2.5 months ago. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Out of London, political analyst Shabir Rezvi, and out of Norway, author and commentator John Stepling. Welcome both of you to the program. Well, let's start off in London. And Shabir, what do you make of this latest? Now, the Americans are saying that they're actually going to unload this tanker that they have stolen. I mean, what is going on? Where is any kind of sense of law and order here? Your take, Shabir.
Hello, good evening. Thank you very much for the invitation. Look, at the end of the day, America regards itself a particularly unique country. They would do whatever they want without any sort of recourse to international law or, whatever the convention would be, because America feels that it has the right to govern the world in their own vision. Therefore, all this sort of talk of following international law, a rule-based order, and again, the rule-based order is really American rule-based order. There is not to be a third party or any kind of rules that apply to other nations. America does what it wants. And as we know, this is also the 70th anniversary of when the coup was organized in Iran to get rid of a democratically elected prime minister, Mossadegh. Were there any international rules operated at that time? No. Obviously, USA wanted to control the Iranian oil directly, but post-Islamic Revolution in 1979, U.S. and its allies, the collective West, have not been able to get away with whatever want in relation to Iran. So they will do these, piracy, which they are good at, because historically the collective West, the colonial powers and the imperialists have carried on piracy continuously for the last 300-400 years.
Okay. Well, John, you've heard what Iran is saying, that they're not going to sit back and let Washington do whatever they want in dealing with Iranian property or infringement on Iranian assets at all. What do you make of that? I mean, Tehran is speaking very strongly about this situation. Your overall assessment of things?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert in maritime law, in the intricacies of maritime law, but that's really not the ultimate issue here. The United States, as your other guest noted, is a colonialist, imperialist power that has stolen and plundered resources from the global South for several hundred years. It just changes the manner in which it plunders things, but it continues to do so. And what is happening? I mean, you have to look at timing. The U.S. is involved at the moment in a prisoner exchange vis-a-vis South Korea with Iran. How this incident will affect that has not been mentioned yet by either country. But also, we see the crisis in Niger and Burkina Faso with regard to uranium and the French essentially theft of uranium in a highly unequal partnership that they've had with Niger for a very long time. It was a former colonial property of France. And we are seeing the global South starting to reject the coercive tactics of the U.S. primarily, but the EU as well. And this standing up to the power, which for all intents and purposes is the U.S., standing up to U.S. economic policy, once that happens, and it's happened a few times now in small ways, it emboldens other countries to do the same thing. And I think the U.S. senses that the global South is starting to find its own confidence and sense of purpose in throwing off the economic shackles of all the international global financial institutions, the World Bank, and so forth, all the Bretton Woods organizations. And you have to remember, the U.S. and the EU, all the colonial powers, they don't want the global South to develop. They want to keep it impoverished. They want to keep it dependent on Western, in quotation marks, aid. They don't want it. They don't want electricity for Africa. They don't want nuclear power for the global South. They want the resources, and they want them cheap at a great profit.
Indeed. All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us on the News Review. Shebi Rezvi, political analyst out of London, John Stepling, author and commentator out of Inderøy, Norway. Thank you so much for being with us on another News Review.
Israeli forces have killed yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. A young man hit by Israeli fire near the city of Jenin hours ago has succumbed to injuries. Our correspondent Monica Ndil was earlier with us and gave us the details.
This morning, the Israeli military raided the town of Azababdi, South Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians accused for being wanted for security reasons. During this military raid, as usual, the Israeli forces use their weapons in order to disperse the Palestinian protesters and Palestinian fighters, who try their utmost in order to force the Israeli soldiers out of this area. a 17-year-old Palestinian Uthman Atif Abu Khanj was wounded during the clashes that took place in Az-Zababdi. Then Palestinian paramedics said that he succumbed to his injuries. Since the beginning of this year, according to Palestinian Ministry of Health, over 220 Palestinians had been killed by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and in the Gaza Strip, of course, including 44 Palestinian minors and 11 female Palestinians.
The UN Special Envoy for the Middle East has called on Israel to stop the demolition of Palestinian structures and the displacement of Palestinians.
I call on Israeli authorities to end demolition of Palestinian-owned property and the displacement and eviction of Palestinians, and to approve additional plans that would enable Palestinians to build legally and address their development needs.
Addressing a Security Council session, Wenis Land also pointed to Israel's expansionist policy in the occupied Palestinian territories. The UN officials stressed that all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Wenis Land also denounced violent treatment of Palestinians by Israeli forces and settlers. He said perpetrators of acts of violence must be held accountable. Further, in his remarks, Wenis Land described the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip as dire.
Madam President, turning to Gaza, the cessation of hostilities continue to hold. Nevertheless, the humanitarian situation remains dire. The reporting period saw higher than normal electricity shortages of up to 12 hours per day, driven by a lack of capacity to meet soaring demands during the summer.
Gaza, which is home to some 2 million Palestinians, has been under Israeli siege since 2007. The tight blockade of the territory has caused a decline in the standards of living, as well as unprecedented levels of unemployment and poverty. The regime refuses to allow the entry of medical equipment and spare parts for devices that are needed to treat thousands of patients in Gaza. Hospitals in the besieged coastal territory are in dire need of such equipment. Moving on to the BRICS summit, where a bloc of five major economies is due to convene in Johannesburg later today. The South African president will host his Chinese and Brazilian counterparts, the Indian prime minister, the Russian foreign minister, as well as some 50 leaders from other countries. BRICS is expected to consider granting new memberships during a three-day summit, as over 40 countries have expressed interest in joining the bloc. They include Iran, that applied for the membership last year. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has also been invited to attend the gathering in Johannesburg. South Africa currently holds the rotating chairmanship of the group, which represents 40% of the world's population across three continents. Its members' economies also make up a quarter of the global GDP. Author and international affairs commentator Hanan Hussein told us why many countries are trying to gain BRICS membership.
A lot of motivations for them to kind of zero in on this non-U.S. influence. So when we look at key reference points, such as the fact that they want to increase local trade and kind of present that as an arrangement for future members to also be a part of, is in turn an indication that countries are a bit more wary of how the U.S. in certain situations can use the dollar-dominated system to kind of target countries as well. Even though de-dollarization is both institutionally a difficult feat to accomplish and does not align with the multipolarity of certain countries within the alliance, they would want to build greater self-sufficiencies in terms of local currencies to kind of ensure that BRICS countries are able to, kind of step up trade without exactly having to bear the political cost of, that transition.
Okay, we have Jamal Wakim, professor of international relations at the Lebanese University, rejoining us here to talk about this statements made by the UN envoy about the situation of Palestinians and their predicament when it comes to the occupied territories and Gaza. I don't want to sound unprofessional, but when it comes to the Palestinian cause, the question that I have may seem a little out of the professional sphere, but I'm just wondering what happens when you have this UN envoy that I think he's addressing some press people, reading off a paper accusing Israel of what it's doing in the occupied territories, including the Gaza Strip, and blaming it for the different types of violations that are taking place, which is quite horrendous, especially when it comes to the Gaza Strip. I mean, what happens? He just reads something, and then he goes on to the next item on his agenda? I mean, shouldn't this be addressed, or maybe it is, be addressed to a particular person inside this extreme cabinet in Israel, and for there to be a follow-up, for there to be an answer, and therefore to be something done? Because obviously we're looking at, I'm not too sure how long the siege on the Gaza Strip has been, but also the occupied territories, the violations taking place for decades now.
Well, too bad, this is not new with regards to the United Nations and its stance towards the Palestinian situation, or the conditions that the Palestinians live in, either in Gaza Strip or in other occupied territories by Israel. The problem is that the United Nations is hesitant to take any action towards this issue, especially that it's blocked from having such an action by the United States, which controls the United Nations, and Western countries, who are predominant in this international system, which is reflected in the structure of the United Nations and the balance of power inside this international organization. So the Palestinian people and non-Western people don't wait for anything with regards to a UN stance towards the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian problems. And usually the UN issues such reports just to lay off the blame off its shoulders and try to say that it's doing its role as stated in its charter, which is not the case, because we see that in other cases there was a more active role by the United Nations in order to alleviate the suffering of some people, whereas when it comes to the Palestinian people, to Arab people, and to Muslim people all around the world, the conditions are different, and the approach of the United Nations is different. This is due to the bias by the Western world and the United States, which control the United Nations and use it as a tool or an extension of its soft power to promote its own geopolitical agenda with this regard to the Charter of Human Rights and to the international law.
Thank you very much for that, Jamal Bokin, Professor of International Relations at the Lebanese University. Thank you. Moving on, West Africa's main regional bloc has rejected a proposal by Niger's military leaders to hold elections for transition to a civilian rule within 3 years. The ECOWAS commissioner said the bloc wants Niger's president, Mohamed Bazoum, to be released without preconditions and constitutional order restored without further delay. Abdel Fattah Moussa's remarks came after an ECOWAS delegation visited Niger's capital and met with the deposed president and the military leader, General Tiani. ECOWAS has threatened military intervention if talks with Niger's military government fail. In a televised address on Saturday, Tiani said the country's military leaders are open to dialogue to avert a conflict with ECOWAS. However, he warned that the country is ready to defend itself in case of an act of aggression. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran
via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Face to face.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. Today, we are in an exclusive interview program with Dr. Safari, the Deputy for Economic Diplomacy at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Hello, Dr. Safari, and thank you for your presence in this special interview program. If you could please explain the reasons behind Iran's attention to the development of economic and trade relations with Latin American countries, I would appreciate it.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. You are aware that the 13th government had focused more on its foreign policy towards neighboring countries as its first priority. But we can interpret it as focusing on neighboring countries in addition to Africa and Latin America, because Africa is very important to us. I am only talking about the economic dimensions. The political aspect is separate. So we could work simultaneously with neighboring countries, as well as Africa and Latin America. Among our neighbors are the countries in the Caspian Sea region, as well as Central Asia, and to other countries like Georgia and Armenia, which we consider as our neighbors. All right, in addition to that, we have other target countries such as India, Russia, and China. Russia is our neighbor, and as they say, simultaneously, we started the development work with Africa and Latin America. Regarding Latin America, our priority became the countries that are aligned with us in foreign policy: Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. Now, whether our relations with them are beneficial to the country or not, I would like to mention one point. Most of our plans, besides the political issues, which can be around 10% to 20%, are focused on our objectives. 80% of the issues are economic. All right? Our aim is to generate revenue for the country. Our exports to those countries, our imports from those countries in terms of necessary goods, and the transfer of our technology and knowledge-based companies that have the ability to export and, alongside that, the ability to transfer technology. So the framework is defined in this way. The export of consumer goods from our country to those other countries, this has been one of our objectives. Second, the import of raw materials, including agricultural and essential goods, as well as mineral commodities. There are many goods in the country that we have, but due to high production, especially in the steel industry, both in the blast furnace and non-blast furnace sectors, we need the necessary raw materials like nickel and copper, etc. This is our objective. All of these are aimed at generating revenue and transferring technology, exporting knowledge-based products. The Supreme Leader emphasized these items in his speech in the new year. All right, so our move towards Venezuela, alongside knowledge-based products, also includes providing engineering services. For example, in Venezuela, in the energy sector, energy includes electricity, oil, gas refineries, and gas pumping stations. We have very good cooperation in this complex, and an important part of it is our provision of engineering services. I won't mention a specific country, but this is part of our objectives, to secure our future markets through the provision of engineering services. So developing new markets alongside maintaining the previous ones. For example, if we had $1 billion in exports to a country, we first need to stabilize that. Last year, it reached $3.2 billion.
Last year?
Yes, in 1401. The first step is $10 billion. The second step is $20 billion. How will this be achieved? We have funds that need to be created. Producing means establishing our shipping line, which is logical in creating this line. This work should be continuous. Our rival countries send a ship there every week. If we want to supply our consumer goods, which have a very strong market, we cannot send them every 3 or 4 months irregularly, because someone who goes to the supermarket there relies on our products to be supplied regularly. This is one of the essential things that our airline should take shape there. We have almost 6 or 7 knowledge-based projects contracted there. We have established a technology center there, which is a showcase of our capabilities and power. There is a very good space there for our medical equipment, our medicines, our cancer drugs, not just nanomedicines, but bios. In the neighboring country there, which I won't mention the name, after COVID-19, some countries mostly took advantage of this situation and made a profit, for example, in blood cancer. Now, I don't know what they injected, and I don't want to mention the name. If we have a regular shipping line, they will consume our simple syrups, headache tablets, as well as other simple item products. Has a decision been made on this now? This decision has been made. The president has given the order, and he has given an encouraging order as well. And shipping has promised once every 3 months, but we have requested it to be once a month, and later on, once every 15 days. Well, when our merchants see this space, now they are getting shares in the form of partnership in stores that can supply these goods. So our trade sector, our knowledge-based sector, our technology homes, you see now the Islamic Republic of Iran, when it goes to these countries, they request it as a country. Please rebuild the refinery for us. Sir, we want your knowledge of that specific nanomedicine.
Meaning production in the region?
Yes, both nano and bio. The four new sciences in the world, IT, nano, bio, and cognitive. Well, the Islamic Republic of Iran is very good in all four of these sciences. The country we visited, Indonesia, also has the same demand. If you remember, in Indonesia, in the presence of two presidents, remote robotic surgery was tested up to 500 kilometers. You see which countries have this device. One or two countries. Well, Indonesia has 3,000 islands where people live. This country is in great need of such a device. Well, its president immediately announced they want to place orders for 14 hospitals in addition to various goods. And therefore, Iran is referred to as a country that has technology. That is, when Iran presents its goods and technology, customers are immediately found worldwide, both in the field of education and technology transfer, and regarding our products. One of the main things that they usually ask is the establishment of technical colleges and the provision of the opportunity for education. Now we're working with several African countries and establishing a technical college. There are many applicants. Exactly the same thing is being done there. Besides this, we had a trip to Nicaragua, and of course, what we do there is on a smaller scale because the population of Nicaragua is smaller. Their demands from Iran included areas such as medicine, technology, trade, nanotechnology, biomedicines, and more. It is the same in the field of energy and the establishment of power plants. I mean, these requests are always there. There is nothing outside of this framework. These countries enjoy rich mines. For example, we're working on minerals like lead and nickel in Cuba, which are needed for battery factories. We are building a battery factory there in Cuba so that we can have a share in the market. Also, don't forget about aluminum rim. One of the important tasks during the president's visit to Latin America was the revival of projects that had been dormant for 9 years. One of them was tractor manufacturing, which was revived, started, and the factory is producing today. Car manufacturing is also another project. Before that, of course, Saipa and Iran Khodro, two Iranian major auto factories, had sold 3,000 vehicles. These companies actually announced the need, receive the delivery, that is, cars, and then sell them with reasonable prices. This is beneficial for both their ministry and us. This factory was revived for manufacturing autos. We import some parts needed for our industry from other countries for the purpose of producing the cars. In those countries, their Ministry of Industry suggested and introduced some factories to Iranian parts. There is a lot of aluminium bauxite there. The mines are very rich. Our future is in Africa. The future of Iran is in these types of countries. Look, we don't mean to get a PhD in African countries. We just plan to go there to earn money and bring foreign currency to Iran. All the countries of the world go there and take various products to their country, including gold, diamonds, iron ore, copper, nickel, lithium, etc. What economic activity have we done in African countries in the past 40 years? I have always emphasized that our future is there. You must know that in African countries, vehicles are right-hand drive. Same in France. That is, wherever the British have had presence, the steering wheel of cars is on the right side. We negotiated to Saipa managers, and within 2 months, they provided right-hand drive vehicles immediately, and we sent them to Africa. And so far, they have placed an order for 15,000 cars. Or our pickup trucks are great for rural work.
Dr. Safari, can you also please explain about extraterritorial cultivation?
Extraterritorial cultivation has been discussed in Venezuela. Several thousand hectares were given to us before, but it was not followed up. But during this recent trip of the president to Latin America, an order was given. It is being followed up, but it should be within the framework of the law. For example, suppose we want to work in the field of iron ore mining. It must be within the framework of regulations. We need to respect the target country. And also, this cooperation should be win-win. We are not similar to some countries which go to African countries to loot their resources. And God is the witness that we act within the framework of the laws and regulations, and at the same time, we benefit a lot. For example, job creation. When we say that we want to bring foreign currency and realized exports, this is true. Tell you something. A series of goods must be imported from a series of specific countries. For example, aluminum powder. Our problem was that we did not use to diversify the sources of our imports that I mentioned. Someone asked me how you import currency for the country. I said it is very simple. Instead of always importing a certain product from a certain country, I import from three countries. They compete and we are the winners, were our demands. I said many times we used to import chemical fertilizers such as potash and phosphate. Then we diversified our sources of import to four countries. Now we imported cheaper, and we did something that the previous country called us to see why we don't purchase from them anymore. We had created some fake limits. We also had little experience when it came to purchasing goods. We were always in a rush, and we would accept the conditions of the other party for self-profit and other issues, but not now. In addition, today we have launched a potash and phosphate mine in Khoran Biabanak, a county in Iran's Isfahan province. You need to go there and make a movie. Today, within a year, 800 people are working there. 400 trucks are working in the mine. These raw materials are being produced for the factory that is going to be established in the south of Iran, with excellent technology and internal and external partnerships. They claim that there is no foreign investment and the required capital is missing. But no, we see today that it is coming. And even in the case of phosphoric acid that we produce, well, it requires high technology. It is the phosphoric acid that creates the potash. We travel the countries and figure out what to trade from where, for example, regarding meat. Why should our meat come from Australia in small amounts and using Emirates Airlines? We can bring from Africa. Now, the Germans, the French, Qatar, and the UAE are all importing meat from Africa. Thank God things are on track, and good follow-ups are being done, and the results are tangible.
One of the debates that is being discussed in various media of the world these days is the issue of de-dollarization from trades at the international level, especially among the BRICS countries. One of these countries is Brazil, which is actually a Latin American country. During the recent present visit to the three countries of Latin America, which you are also a member of the team, was this issue brought up about using national currencies in trade exchanges in international trades?
The national currency is the second phase, but the first phase is barter trade. See, for example, the same country you mentioned, 90% of the country whose economy hinges on agriculture need urea. Well, we have plenty of urea. We sell it to country A, and then in return, we go and bring goods from country B. Regarding Brazil, our total exports and imports are approximately $5 to $6 billion. But this year and last year, we only managed to have urea exports worth of $2 billion. We are developing this process on different products and goods. For example, India is another country that needs our urea. All African countries are in need of urea. All Latin American countries want urea. Well, if Iran intends to import rice, the path is clear. Of course, this technique is not that old. What you said is absolutely correct. This is one of our goals in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization itself, that we're looking for trades based on national currencies. And in fact, we have numerous trades with many of our neighboring countries using national currencies, whether their national currency or our national currency. Of course, there are well-defined mechanisms. We also have platforms. Most countries are like this. Figures are promising. There are many claims that it is not possible, but you don't pay attention to those talks. We are doing this now. We are also bringing foreign currency into the country. Our central bank, along with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, have a very good cooperation in this field. Recently, they had a meeting among ACU countries. In that meeting, in addition to the member states, many observers were also invited who were cooperating in this field. For example, if you want to cooperate with country A, we have a special platform for it, and your communication is done through these special platforms.
Regarding the recent visit of Mr. Raisi to three Latin American countries, we know that there are other significant countries in that region which have good political and commercial relations with Iran, such as Brazil, Bolivia, and Ecuador. Are we expecting official visits to these countries also in the near future?
Yes, there are plans for such visits. But the president, in addition to the neighboring countries, has plans to work on African countries, which, if I am correct, there are 54 of them. Maybe the number is more. Each of these countries is gold, and by gold I mean opportunity for work from both political and economic aspects. The Chinese have annual summits with their leaders. The Turks do the same, the Russians do the same, the Americans and the Europeans do the same. Therefore, it's been ordered to focus on African countries. Personally, I think that there should be more trips to African countries with the goals I mentioned. Earning currency for the country, creating jobs, exporting knowledge, exporting technical and engineering services. In an African country, you can easily get orders for mass construction projects of 15, 20, 50,000 apartments. When, for example, such a project is taken, the construction materials should also be exported there. And you open your own construction products market in that country. The same is true for medicine and equipment. We now have plans to work with some African countries in the Victoria Island, which are, I think, about 4 to 5 countries. Our technology centers are growing in African countries.
The same is happening in Latin American countries, isn't it?
Regarding the countries of Latin America, I wanted to mention that, for example, Brazil is among our target countries, and also Ecuador and Bolivia and other countries which are also interested in cooperation with Iran. We have exports to those countries, and they in fact need us.
Is there an estimate of the potential volume of trades with Latin American countries, apart from Venezuela, that you mentioned in the first phase? We had trades of volume of $10 billion, and in the second phase, $20 billion. How much is it for the entire continent of Latin America?
In fact, if I speak of numbers, there may be some criticism against my claims, but the market is very good and rich. And by market, I don't mean just exports. If the market is capable of providing us with raw materials, it is still very beneficial. That is, if we can import iron ore, nickel, and various metals or minerals to boost our production, that is good. Why not? Let's do it. Today, our steel factories are working with 50% concentrate in the first phase. Why? Because we don't have enough iron ore. Now, some people have announced that they are ready and willing to export and sell us raw materials. We definitely welcome such suggestions. At the moment, since we are not developed in such areas, we do not have enough raw materials needed for our factories. If our factories work at full capacity, our exports will double. These materials can be easily imported from Latin American and African countries. Cuba, for example, this country is rich in nickel, and Nicaragua has a lot of silver and other metals that are needed by our industries.
Dr. Safari, what is the most important challenge you see in the way of expanding relations with Latin American countries?
The main challenge on the way to our exports and businesses, in my opinion, is shipping. This is the most important point. The president also has issued the relevant orders in this regard. Because if Iran has irregular shipping, it will improve a lot. Iran does not make the necessary parts in another country, such as a car that it then wants to assemble inside. Iran needs to create jobs here, make parts and ship them there to be fulfilled. Therefore, shipping is the most important category of our work. Now, aside from the problems in the customs area, we shouldn't ignore the importance of shipping lines. Continuity of supply of parts and raw materials required in various fields is very important. The good point is that the Iranian president has already given the necessary orders in this regard, and they are being followed up both in Africa and in Latin America.
Dr. Safari, thank you very much for giving your time. Thank you.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. This is Hamza Azizi from IRIB English Radio in series of For Humanity program. My dear audience, I'm sure you remember that we've been talking in previous episodes about the human rights in the Holy Book. We talked about the right of life and the price of life in the Holy Book and the status of life in the Holy Book. But before that, we reminded our dear audience that whatever right that we are going to introduce in these series of talks are the rights among the human beings themselves. There is no duality between God and human being in imagining such rights. When we are talking about the rights of human beings, we are not talking about the rights that human beings have against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So there is no right for human beings to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala about that. These rights are the ones that human beings have in the interaction and relation with each other. The second right that we are going to talk about, and it's going to be a little bit comprehensive, it's the right of freedom. Of course, this topic is a very both comprehensive and a very challenging and critical discussion. The thing that there are many disagreements and disputes between Islamic ideology and Quranic culture versus the Western culture and Western ideology. There are many schools of thought. They have talked about the right of freedom. There are many philosophers who have talked about that, and they analyzed and elaborated many aspects of that. But we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, before all of those schools of thought and all of those philosophers and scholars, has touched very carefully and cleverly the issue of freedom. When we talk about different types of freedom, even you will understand and you will find out that there are even some types of freedom that it is a kind of innovation in the Holy Book. In comparison with what the philosophers, Western philosophers, and other schools of thought have brought to the human beings. There are some creativities, we can say. One of the very significant type of freedom is a kind of spiritual freedom. Or let's say freedom from the corporeal aspect of life. The Holy Book, from the very beginning, tries to open a new window and to give a new observation to the human beings, because normally human beings in their daily life, they are dealing with the desirable and materialistic aspect of their life. So this is a new kind of freedom that we are going to talk about that after a short break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience, brothers and sisters, to the series of For Humanity program. I'm Hamza Azizi from IRB English Radio. We've been talking about the human rights in the Holy Quran, and we said that one of the very significant rights of human beings is the right for freedom. And we said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has brought creatively some of the new types of human rights of freedom that even the Western schools of thought and even the Western philosophers didn't think of. And one of those is the right of spiritual freedom, or freedom of the corporeal aspect of life. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the holy chapter of Ali Imran, verse 14, he brings a very comprehensive verse talking about different material desires of human beings, corporeal desires of human beings. زُيَّنَ لِلنَّاسِ حُبُّ الشَّهَوَاتِ. He says that to mankind has been made to seem decorous the love of desires. And these desires have different objects and examples, including women, children, accumulated piles of gold and silver, horses of mark, livestock, and farms. So these are different types of desires, material desires, corporeal desires, that normally human beings daily are dealing with them. And there are many other verses as well that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tries to insinuate to the human beings and teach human beings that this is only the least and the cheapest aspect of human life. So there are many other better and more precious aspects of life that we haven't think of, that we haven't thought of. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in another chapter, when he wants to talk about the life in this universe, the worldly life, about dunya, he says that dunya and its life is like a blossom. Zahrat al-hayat al-dunya. Have you looked at a blossom? A blossom is very beautiful, but has a very, very short life. Only some days. It's not going to stay, it's not going to remain. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that the life of human being in this universe is like that. So he tries to teach to human beings to get free of these kinds of desires, not to be surrounded, not to be limited, not to be stuck in these kinds of desires. So this is a kind of, we call it spiritual freedom, that it's a kind of innovation of the Holy Quran. Thank you very much. Have a good time. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.
صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.